Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. They found in the Garcinia, Cambogia, an extract that can help dissolve kidney stones. How about that? Something that will remove calcium oxalate crystals, that is non-toxic, that's all natural. This was University of Houston, and it was published in Nature, the most prestigious scientific publication in the world. Not a word have I found in mainstream media, but for those of you who are tuned in here to hear qualified peer-reviewed scientific discussion, yeah, we talk about it. We have a lot to share today on ways of living a longer and healthier life. But also today, I received a lot of feedback, very positive feedback, from people from all walks of life, from academia to friend of mine who is retired and says, we need to hear more on this because the mainstream media is complicit in denying this side of the story. So today, I will share with you another step in our journey to having a more comprehensive view of the so-called woke generation. It is called the moral panic of the woke generation. Richard Gale and myself. And you'll hear some of the great voices like John Locke, who wrote Essays Concerning Human Understanding, one of the finest essays I've ever read. And you'll hear about the Age of Enlightenment, the Christian Reformation, the Inquisition, the Age of Romanticism, and how that changed the perception of the meaning of reality. So I'm going to take you through a time trip of showing you some of the greatest minds, what we can learn today from them, and how what's going on in the streets is not, it's not unique, it's not original, and it's not going to cause massive positive change, to the contrary. So that will be on today's program. Also today, I wanted to introduce you to some people who have some very profound thoughts, people that are not generally in the media. So I'll be having some of that posted today as well, including a wonderful rabbi who has just a beautiful way of explaining woke culture. Also, continuing with our pros and cons of two different sides of an issue, should you wear to protect yourself the plastic shields, hats, covering your whole face, or a mask, or in my opinion, combination of both. So we're going to continue that. That's a short segment. And so we have a lot to share. So please stay with us. And oh, I'll be also giving you critically important information, fully documenting that Anthony Fauci, the Bill Gates, the Big Pharma, the CDC, World Health Organization, they're in all this hysteria about what we should and shouldn't do. And they're wrong on everything. I mean, everything. So we're going to show you the scientists, physicians who are on the right side of this. We always begin, of course, with the latest on health and healing. And since a lot of people suffer from kidney stones, it's just calcium oxalate crystals, they want to see would something work. And this could lead to the first advances in the treatment of calcium oxalate, probably in the last 30 years. And a group of professors in chemical engineering at the University of Houston went into the background on something that's been used around the world, but not in the United States. And that is the Garcinia, G-A-R-C-I-N-I-A, Cambogia, C-A-M, B-O-G-I-A. And people ask, well, why do I spell everything all the time? Because we have people listening from all over the world, and English may not be their first language. So I want to make sure that they can write it down and then continue to do the research on their own. In any case, the findings are the results of a combination of experimental studies and human studies. Now, for those of you who have not had the misfortune of having a kidney stone is a small, hard mineral deposit that forms inside the kidneys. and affects upwards of 12% of all men and 7% of all women. And high blood pressure and diabetes and obesity can increase the risk. And the reported incidence is on the rise. A lot of it, I believe, comes from an overly high-protein diet, highly acidic foods, and highly acidic beverages, including coffee and sugary soft drinks. In any case, most of the time your doctor will tell you, well, drink lots of water, avoid foods rich in oxalate. By the way, almonds, spinach, okra, rhubarb are also high in oxalate. And also, they recommend taking citrate in the form of potassium citrate, C-I-T-R-A-T-E. That's a supplement that can slow crystal growth. And in any case, that's what they did. They found that kidney stones can be broken down with this therapy. So good, something new that helps us. Also from Washington University in St. Louis comes an interesting story. In fact, I'm going to be writing my next article starting later today, hopefully have it by the next 2 days, about what we can do on a realistic basis to strengthen our immune system. Now, when you strengthen the immune system, especially for older people, especially for people who have comorbidities, meaning you already are sick, you're already speeding up your death process, you're already susceptible to dying from obesity, emphysema, heart disease, cancers, dementia, the big five. So I've worked with so many hundreds of thousands of people in clinical studies, 44 clinical studies, so I know from my own clinical experience, it's not hypothesis, we've published in peer-reviewed journals. I mean, this is the real stuff, that we can prevent a lot of diseases. And the more things you do in the right way, the stronger your immune system. Now, that doesn't mean everyone's 100% immune. It means you put time on your side. You have an advantage. Whereas if you're the average American and everything you're doing every day, from the overuse of cell phones and too close to your computer and too much blue light at night and too much in the way of calories and saturated fats, including arachidonic acid and too much of the sugars, you're actually making yourself extremely susceptible to all forms of pathogens. So here's what they say. They say as the COVID-19 panic continues, which it is, there's a lot of research focused upon the immune system's role with patients who become seriously ill. And quote, the popular theory has it that the immune system gets so revved up fighting the virus that after several days it produces so-called cytokine storm that results in potentially fatal organ damage, particularly into the lungs. But the new findings point to another theory and suggest that patients become ill because their immune systems can't do enough to protect them from the virus, landing them in intensive care units. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So here's where I would challenge them. And this is one of the problems I have with all of the vast majority of science and medicine in the United States. It's monotheistic. What do I mean? Let's say that they do a really good study on vitamin C helping to lessen the likelihood of a prostate cancer or breast cancer. So you look at the study, good institution, lots of people in it, good review. Okay, now, as a doctor, you may or may not use it, but at least there's some evidence that it would work if you chose to use it. But if you ask that same doctor, I saw this study that if you use 20,000 milligrams a day of vitamin C, it can help extend your life with breast cancer. And if you took up to 10,000 milligrams a day, it could help prevent breast cancer. The doctor would say, that's true. That's what the study showed. Well, isn't there some sense of reason that if it would do that for breast cancer, it might do it for lung cancer, colon cancer, bladder cancer, stomach cancer, lymphomas, lipomas? Immediately the answer would be, well, there's no studies on that. So, what you have is phenomena I call intellectual coupling. What do I mean? I mean that the fact that you have learned something, mastered something, or fully cognizant of something in one area doesn't mean that you will connect it to another area based upon the supposition and common sense reason that if it works so well for one kind of cancer, it should have some impact on another type of cancer. That's just reasonable. That's exactly when you get the door closed on you when you're talking with anyone in any field at all. And now try talking with someone that, you know, the problem is police violence. Do you mean all 800,000 police? And do you mean the 3 million people before them who were police, they were all violent? Or you mean certain police have a proclivity for violence, and therefore there should be a better way of screening these people and a better civilian review way of making sure that when you see that someone is on the beat, someone from your neighborhood, someone who grew up where you're at, who knows you, you know them, you can communicate, and part of their job each day is to spend at least an hour to two in the neighborhood speaking at a central place with people who live in that neighborhood, so you have some control over your neighborhood and what goes on there. So if there was some kind of odd behavior, aggressive behavior, hyper aggressive behavior, racist behavior, you could see it, identify it, and then have a way of eliminating the police officer from there. That's one way of looking at it. But then if you took that to say that all police are that way, you'd be wrong. But what keeps us from pulling back and doing something in a more intellectually and emotionally and cognitively judicious manner frequently is this inability to connect issues. And yet life is an interconnection of thousands of issues. And now with identity politics, you're supposed to separate yourself by each one of your identifying characteristics even further, therefore lessening or eliminating the potential to learn from other cultures, other races, other belief systems. So the new idea is, hey, what was that song you were listening to? I just listened to Bob Marley. You're not Jamaican. That's cultural appropriation. You can't do that. I see. So you can only listen to music based upon your culture, your ethnicity? Yes, otherwise it's appropriation, it's microaggression. This is the insanity that's going on. And if you don't stand up and challenge it, it continues. No different than what I've tried my entire career to challenge the medical community, which I support when it works. And for emergency medicine, it's exemplary. For if you have an eye poked out, if you've got a tooth knocked out, if you've got a need for a surgery of your brain or to have an operation that could save your life, if there's a medicine that will save your life, if there's a resuscitation that could save your life, I support it 100%. It's chronic care that we fail at. Preventing or treating cancer, heart disease, inflammations, infections, and, of course, mental health issues. And we're an abysmal failure there. In fact, the worst of all is mental health. In fact, it's so bad that on tonight's Progressive Commentary Hour, I have an attorney for half the program who has spent his in career fighting on behalf of patient rights who have almost no rights. When you're in the institutions, you're in their control. You know, they're going to give you any medication they want. If they deem that you need electroconvulsive therapy, they can give it, even though there's not a single study in the world that substantiates that it relieves the underlying cause of depression. Increased grand mal seizures, which are extremely dangerous in and of themselves, they can kill you. Or they can erase your memory. They can destroy neurons in ways that nothing you could ever eat or drink could destroy. In just half hour, boom, big part of your brain is gone, especially the part dealing with emotive responses, memory. So you have no memory. Oh, that's a good cure. A person was depressed about something, so you just destroy their brain so they don't remember anything. Well, that's really brilliant. So does that mean that if we applied that to other areas, if we've got problems in our knees, cut off the knees. Got a problem with your brain? Take out the brain. This is the downside of an inflexible, intolerable, and a hypersensitive medical industrial paradigm that doesn't change. So you keep going back to your doctor hoping, I just brought the study to you. They don't care. So why don't you find a different doctor and realize how much you can do on your own so you don't need that doctor in the first place? That's what's important. That's That's why I just want to share, if you build up your immune system, think of the people in nursing homes. In fact, it was probably 20 years ago, a gentleman was attending our health support group, and he stood out because he's like 6'8". And when he'd be sitting in the lectures, people behind him had to move because they couldn't see over his head. And he came up and he said, look, I own a nursing home. And I know what your protocols have done for me and my family. I'd like to start implementing these protocols in the nursing home. I said, fine. So one day I sat with him and I asked him, what are the conditions most of the people in his nursing home suffer from? And for each one of those, I gave protocols. Some were common protocols for all conditions, and others to make sure they didn't dehydrate, make sure they had healthy water and juices, and that they were using magnets under their sheets so they didn't end up with the ulcerating sores that kill a lot, and how to stimulate the brain, how to reconnect dendrites in the brain. And suddenly, after about 6 months, he came in one Saturday, and he said, I can't believe it. I have a woman in my nursing home who should have been dead months ago. Not only is she not dead, but her memory's coming back. And, you know, she's communicating with her daughter. And this is terrific. And I said, keep on that. And I changed the protocol. In 6 months, she'll be leaving your nursing home and going back home. That's exactly what happened. So imagine if we took a healthy protocol, or protocols, plural, into all the nursing homes and assisted living centers. I'm even willing to do this. There's a challenge. Anyone listening who is connected to a hospice center, that's where you go to die. I mean, nobody comes out. Ah, but what about Edith? Edith was in Trafalgar Hospital. She had terminal cancer. I didn't know it. She was my editor. And she went the Orthodox route. Tried everything Orthodox had, and it failed. And I only found out she was there when I was in visiting one of the doctors. I was across the street at the Institute of Plant Biology, and I look, and as I'm walking down, there she is. But she's in the hospice part, where they take you from the main hospital and you put you in hospice. And I went in and talked with her, and she had maybe a day or two or three to live. And so I asked the oncologist, could I help her? And he said, no. So we went to the head of the department. I asked, could I help her? No. Why not? She's dying. You acknowledge she's dying. What in the world do you have to lose? Well, it's procedures. So even if someone had an idea that could help her, it's the procedure you should let her die. Well, she's going to die. Why put false hope in her? So Fanny Holtzman, some of you may remember her. She's a very famous attorney. She's one of those Bella Abzug type of attorneys. And she was on the board of the hospital. Well, I was also a trustee of the hospital. So we had a conversation, and then we went to the director, and the director said, okay. So I went in, I went to work. And 3 months later, she had no cancer and left the hospital. Interesting, because no one's ever known that until recently. Dr. Elena wrote a letter to me because she was on her deathbed, having had 7 strokes. And I've never seen anyone in my life as dedicated to her work as her. 7 days a week, I never saw her not there working. And she didn't have a life, she just had that. She's one of those completely committed people. And she wrote a letter to me on her deathbed stating, you know, the things that I didn't know, that they didn't release my information on curing AIDS patients at the Institute of Plant Biology, because the board decided that it would adversely affect the pharmaceutical company's funding to the Institute. But in a different paragraph, she talked about when she came over and saw the patient that was in hospice care, I'd reversed the cancer. No other documentation to that. It would have been one of those things that happened, forgotten, but it's memorialized now, and you can read that letter for yourself. But in any case, wouldn't you think that if you have something that's been shown to work in one area, shouldn't you have an opportunity to apply it in other areas, especially with hospice care where everybody dies? So if anybody here would like to try this, contact my office in New York. Go to prnstudio@gmail.com, prnstudio@gmail.com, and let's see if we can't provide some protocol for hospice patients to improve the quality of their life, to ease their suffering, at the very least get them off the opiates, because that's the terrible thing about hospice care. They're in so much pain that they drug them to where you could be their, you know, daughter or son and walk in, they might not recognize you because they're in that altered state. In any case, I'd like to see if we can save some lives and then have citizen journalists spread that information around, you know, interview the patient's family, interview the head of the hospice care, show what was done, and everything is done, video it. So we can, because we're never, ever, ever in your lifetime or my lifetime, we're never going to have a door that opens to us saying, please come in, sit at the table, and let's discuss possibilities. That'll never happen. So we have to create our own door, and it goes right to the public, bypassing the safeguarders of orthodoxy. So boost up your own immune system, yes, and especially boost it up in people who are vulnerable, yes. They're the ones who should be in quarantine, but in a healthy quarantine, not the ones that we've advocated. And there's a way to helping a person in quarantine build up their immune system to keep them alive. Okay, that's how I would respond. One more thing before we take a break. Blueberries can help support your muscles. Yeah, now I talked about the branched-chain amino acids, and that's one of the reasons when people were in the anti-aging retreat, this is so funny. There was one woman who was very determined that she was going to make this work, very serious. And she was not in good shape when she started. But on her last day, she said, I'm ready. And I said, let's go out. And there was another guy finishing. And I said to the guy, I said, just take your time, do your own walk at your own pace, and see how far you can go. So I was with him. All right, so they started. And he went out very fast, and she went out at a good pace. At the end of this, mind you, we're talking about senior citizens, out of shape. And at the end of that day, she had done a full marathon, and her last mile, race walking, was 12:02. To give you an idea, had she been in a national championship in her age group, she would have won the gold medal easily. And the guy she caught in the last mile. So with like 100 feet to go, he stops. Oh, you know, I got a pain. Yeah, sure, you got a pain. Your ego's got a pain. Pace yourself. But then she did things that I've never seen before in my entire career. She had to stop doing these deep weighted knee bends, I think at 800. 800. Try that. If you don't think that's hard. Sit-ups and pull-ups and standing on one leg with your eyes closed, and all this is in the gym. I'm timing all, measuring all this. Unbelievable. And that's just the beginning. She's continued since. Imagine if a whole nation began to do that. Do you realize what that would do for your immune system? Wow. Especially in the group we're saying are most susceptible, who are most susceptible to COVID, we could save lives. So I was putting branched amino acids and all their protein shakes, and they were having three a day. So you could start to see muscle and sagging skin began to tighten up because their muscle mass under the skin was tightening up, and abs started to show. Oh, it was just so exciting to see this, especially in a 95-year-old, a 94-year-old, an 82-year-old. Wow. So imagine if we just got motivated as a whole world and started to give ourselves no excuse. You have to have discipline and focus in order to get anything achieved in life. Without discipline and focus, you will stop and go back and forth and back and forth, and you'll never get to where you're going. One day you'll wake up and you're looking at the back of your head. You've gone in a circle with no achievement. You need discipline. Kick yourself in the butt. Get serious. So now blueberries can add even more than the branched amino acids or more to the branched amino acids. This is Cornell University, published in the Journal of Nutrition. The study included women and men who consume 19 grams, that's not even an ounce of freeze-dried strawberries in the morning and evening. And if it was not freeze-dried, it'd be equivalent to about a cup and three quarters of fresh blueberries a day for 6 weeks, in addition to their regular diet. Nothing else changed. And that's flooding your body with polyphenols and anthocyanins. And they collected before and after the morning doses, their serum, to see what was happening with the human cultured human muscle progenitor cells, which determine the effects of blueberries on muscle cell proliferation, oxidation, and metabolism. And blueberries helped support muscle. So, message for everyone out there, have blueberries in your diet, and it'll help your muscles. That's good. And anyhow, that's just, I realize that some people are going to take their aspirin, and because I believe in freedom of choice, do what you want to do. But from Massachusetts General Hospital, published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, aspirin may accelerate the progression of advanced cancers in older adults. So just remember that. That's a study. And compelling evidence for this. So when you take aspirin and you're older, and it can advance cancers, and you can die. So that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to come back in a moment. And when we do, we're going to hear from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. I played a segment of his about 2 weeks ago, and people liked it. So we're going to play this one on cancel culture. We'll play maybe about 8 minutes, because I've got a long commentary I've got to do today to address the moral panic of the woke generation before they run everyone over a cliff, which they're doing now. Oh, and by the way, think back. Remember when I talked about the America's going to de-evolve into green zones at midnight to 5 in the morning and then throughout the day? The looters came and they tried to rob every single store, running cars in the windows of all the top high-end. Now, the Miracle Mile is on the most expensive piece of real estate in Chicago. It's where all the millionaires live. It's right on the water, Lake Michigan. It's right across the street. And that's where they went. So if these people were able to go and crash and loot everything, destroy everything, and they went up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, how long do you think it's going to be before they hit Rodeo Drive and Fifth Avenue? Now, based upon what we're seeing, this is a reality, because there are gangs in America, there are agent provocateurs, there are people who are anarchists, and they're seeing what they can get away with. So this is the beginning of going into that very dark place that as a nation we don't deserve to be and we shouldn't be put in. You shouldn't fear walking down the street. You shouldn't fear, being shot. And yet that's where we're at today. So we're going to talk about the cancel culture. You'll have a chance to call in and share your points of view. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. We're 30 minutes into our program. And by the way, tonight, I'm setting aside half of our program tonight to talk about what's wrong with our mental health care system. How about everything? All the drugs, the antidepressants, the antipsychotics, the fact that if you look on the actual insert of every one of the antidepressants, depression is, as a side effect, is actual effect of the drug. An antipsychotic medication, psychosis, is a side effect of the medication with suicidal ideation. It's just all wrong. But then the second half of the show, I'm going to do on positive ways, inspirational ways of dealing with all the problems we're faced with. So it'll be a journey into the problem and a big journey out of the problem into solutions. That's tonight at 7 o'clock on Progressive Radio Network. Back in a moment.
Social death.
Social death. Social ostracization. Being cancelled.
Yeah.
We were talking about that earlier.
To tease us out a bit, this what you might, for want of a better term, the empathy culture. You dare not offend somebody. You ought to wrap them in cotton wool. I don't mean to say that we should be cruel, but you know what I mean by that. So that they're not offended. Your courses are designed around not offending students as a priority, rather than challenging them, stretching them, exposing them to different thinking. That seems to be very much against young people's interests. That's the first point. The second point, though, that strikes me as remarkable about the so-called empathy culture is that the point you've just made. If you dare to disagree with it, politeness goes right out the door. They don't seem to matter how badly they hurt you or break you or damage you. Mm-hmm. How do we understand this desire on the one hand to mollycoddle people and wrap them in cotton wool so that they're not challenged, but to absolutely excoriate anybody else who dares to adopt a different position in the field of ideas?
It's a very deep and beautiful idea. It's a very religious idea. Common to Judaism and Christianity, hate the sin, love the sinner. And this belongs to a particular view of morality, which says that I am one thing and my acts are another. That I can criticize somebody's acts,
yes,
without devaluing the person. And we're losing that distinction. And we're losing a similar distinction between me, the person, and the views I happen to espouse, or the life choices that I have. When I was a student at Cambridge, my postgraduate tutor, the late Sir Bernard Williams,
yes,
was Britain's most distinguished atheist. He was most distinguished philosopher of his generation, but he was, I mean, an absolute genius, a lapsed Catholic, and an incredibly brilliant man. And I, by that time, had become quite religious. And we could not have been more different. It was just, there was an abyss between us in terms of our beliefs. But he never belittled my beliefs. He never felt, let me feel humiliated or rejected or in any shape or form. He was respectful the whole time. The only thing he insisted was that I was lucid, that I was cogent, that he understood what I was saying, that it made sense. And so I felt very, very respected, even though my views were clearly very challenged. And I think we lose that. And today, we have to get back to that situation of seeing that the university is really fulfilling its role in preparing us for the public conversation, preparing us for meeting people who are not like us, by teaching us to listen respectfully to those with whom we disagree, in the sure knowledge that they will listen respectfully to our views. And that's what universities should be modeling.
That's a sort of do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It often requires, you see, love is not always just a feeling. It's a doing thing. Mm. It's a willingness through gritted teeth to say, I disagree with what this person is saying so strongly that I'm tempted to give and take offense.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute we do that, we're both going to be diminished.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get a suboptimal outcome. Mm. We have to. I mean, I had to learn this in politics. You know, you've got to rise above it and seek to engage with the idea. But that's not what we're doing at the moment. There's something that follows on. In our judgmentalism, we seem to be finding it very hard to forgive.
Well, I feel very strongly about this. The Americans, after Pearl Harbor, did something extremely interesting. One of the most interesting things I ever came across a government doing. They realized that they were going to have to wage war against a country they didn't understand. And so they asked an anthropologist by the name of Ruth Benedict. And basically they said, Ruth, explain the Japanese to us. And she did, and it was later published as a book called The Chrysanthemum and the Sword. And she explained the difference between a shame culture, yeah, and a guilt culture. shame and honor, guilt and righteousness. Very, very different cultures. America is a guilt culture. Japan was a shame culture. Now, in a guilt culture, there is that separation between the person and between the sinner and the sin. So that even though the person sinned, nonetheless, they remain intact and you forgive, you can forgive. A guilt culture is a culture of forgiveness because the person remains pure, whatever. A shame culture is unforgiving. If you have been shamed, then, you know, you go off quietly and commit suicide.
Yes.
Now, the West, being a Christian guilt culture, always had space for forgiveness. But today, the West is no longer a Christian culture. It's a media-driven culture. And we are in one of the supreme shame cultures of all time. That's what viral social media do to you. You get it wrong, that's it. You are shamed for life. And shame cultures don't have space for forgiveness. And that's why we've lost forgiveness in public life.
Very dangerous.
Very important statement. We don't have room for forgiveness today. Wow. If you agree with what I'm about to share with you, please share it with other people, because it's the only way that our voices, which are not the mainstream media, have a chance to being heard by other people. We need unity at this point. There are hundreds of thousands of us who are in the field of helping people, whether you're a dietitian or life coach, a personal trainer, a holistic doctor, dentist, nurse, chiropractor. But we're not working together yet. We have hundreds of millions of patients collectively. So we have strength in numbers, in experience. Bring it together. In any case, share this as far and wide as you can. It's entitled The Moral Panic of the Woke Generation. It's one thing to show a man that he is in error and another to put him in touch with truth. Another statement, no man's knowledge can go beyond his experience. John Locke. Locke, by the way, was not alone in questioning what we believe to be true knowledge and pointing out the consequences of failing to discern falsehoods from reality. In fact, Locke, that's spelled L-O-C-K-E, was in excellent company. Due to the scientific revolution that inspired several generations of deep thinkers, naturalists and philosophers, including Rousseau, Kant, Spinoza, Darwin, Bacon, Voltaire, we had then the Age of Enlightenment, or it's also called the Age of Reason. It's one and the same. They were not two separate. And they dominated the intellectual world of ideas for about 200 years. Locke's statements are important because today there is a new generation that has been indoctrinated by the shortcomings of scientific materialism originally launched during the Age of Reason. It was intended to bring forth a new purity, an idyllic perfectionism of thought in beliefs founded alone upon objective inquiry. Now we are observing a juvenile revolution in the ideas of identity politics, wokeness, and a passionate microaggression that derives hedonistic pleasure in ridicule and insult. One of its more lofty goals is to end free speech as we know it, except for those who are woke. Other goals are to institute a faux collectivism and to abolish meritocracy or social rewards earned through your own personal effort and achievement. Ah, there is the rub. Because today, in the woke generation, the individual does not count. The collective voice does. What if the collective voice is wrong? Well, who's to judge them? They are the ultimate judge of everything and everyone. Important voices of critical thought, Noam Chomsky, Henry Giroux, Jordan Peterson, to name just a few, have been warning us for over a decade that this day was rapidly approaching. However, since there are no dynamic leaders in the youth woke movement of Mao-style cleansing and purging wrong views, wrong attitudes and wrong beliefs, most of us in the older generations wrongly assume it'll be a passing phase. Not true. It's here. And it's getting worse. It's metastasizing. In fact, the consequences of this unleashed furor, evidenced by an absence of self-reflection or critical thought, has been channeled into a mob rule of dissent and abuse. In the street gatherings of protest and across the social media, it is virtually unstoppable at this moment. Not one of us who are not a part of them is asked for an opinion. What would we do, those of us, the thousands, the millions of us who've been in the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the earth movement, the animal rights movement, the human rights movement, spending decades? What wisdom have we gained to help them? Not a question. They are uninterested. No one is challenging them, neither the mainstream media nor the majority of academia. Rather, corporate leaders and pervasive forces in the democratic institutions are coming to their aid and covering their omissions and sins. Therefore, it proceeds under the cover of a silent political power to sustain its energy. On the other hand, today's youth have every reason to feel disenchanted and to suffer rampant existential angst, the emptiness of not feeling a deeper sense of purpose and meaning in the world at large. American neoliberal cultures and our educational systems' single-minded attention to science and technology, which in themselves are amoral disciplines, and rote memorization and testing has resulted in 2 decades of youth becoming essentially, shall I say, functionally illiterate. Illiterate in the humanities, illiterate in history, illiterate in philosophy, illiterate in ethics, illiterate in critical evaluation, illiterate in reflective inquiry. Talking with the average woke person is one of the most exasperating conversations one could have, because there's just an empty vessel plugged into an artificial system that gives it its marching orders. It is also the most irreligious generation in American history, without the skills of introspection, thought, to develop a sense of genuine well-being and true happiness, or what Plato called eudaimonia as opposed to hedonia, the pursuit of temporary or transient pleasures. Our nation has tossed our youth in the rabid dog pen of social Darwin rat race for survival. Therefore, it is not surprising that suicides among today's teens and 20-somethings have risen 47% in the past 20 years. Sadly, the casual rate is actually higher when we consider there are 36% more people living in their 20s today than there were at the turn of the century. 32% of youth through their 20s have clinical anxiety disorder. 1 in 9 suffer from depression, and almost 14% have ADHD. Although the medical community would like us to believe that these are either inherited or biological conditions attributable to brain chemical imbalance, there's absolutely zero scientific consensus or proof proving there is a causal relationship between brain function and mental states. Certainly there are correlate relationships, but correlation is not causation. The latter is solely a belief, an assumption, without any conclusive or confirming data. I'm feeling something, therefore it must be real. No, what you're feeling, more often than not, is coming from a deeper vortex of the epigenetically controlled conditioned self. You could be reflective at an emotional level to something that happened to you, an assault, an abuse, or the indifference of parenting when you were young. Now you're misplacing that angst towards the moment you're in and going into a petrified state of what do I do? I don't know what to do. I don't know what actions to take. And hence back to the redundancy of a simplistic, addictive state of mind. And most Americans, young or older, are in an addictive state, not to hard drugs, some are, but rather addictive to patterns and ritual routine where it no longer requires critical thought or deep introspection. Think of it this way. There was a physician, highly respected in the state of Oregon. She was head at one time of the Pediatricians Association. She was a board-certified pediatrician, but she had an awakening, a catharsis, and she realized that no artificial formula could ever do for a child what a mother's breast milk will do for the immunity building of that child. So she stopped promoting artificial formula and began promoting breastfeeding. She was attacked for that. Her license was attacked. I saw her when she came to New York asking for my assistance. This is during the great purges of all alternative or complementary medicine and its thought. Even the progenitor of an idea was anathema to those who lacked critical thinking. She had been before then the court counselor for teens. These were mainly teens from affluent parents, doctors, lawyers, engineers, architects, scientists. And she said that they were acting out, getting into trouble. This was juvenile court. And she spoke with hundreds of parents. The parents did not understand why the child acted out, stole something, sold a car. Why? You have everything you want. We give you everything. Yes, except their time and undivided attention. Their career came first. Do you think that's any less true 30 years later with the parents, the helicopter parents, the bulldozer parents, the nanny state parents? Every second of every day is planned out. There's little time for spontaneity, little time for not career-driven angst. As a result, the child experiences all this, and yet we do not ever blame the parenting for what occurs in the outcast mindset of a child. Therefore, the causes are elsewhere and likely to be found in a dysfunctional society with a complete breakdown of traditional ethical structures and universal values, including, at one time, pretty darn good family values. In 1972, South African sociologist Stanley Cohen proposed the moral panic theory. It's an irrational, widespread fear that threatens one's sense of values and safety and cohesion to one's tribal identity. This moral panic, Cohen observes, is bolstered by the injustices of the ruling elite and its mouthpieces in the media. It also centers around those who society marginalizes and based upon ethnicity, class, sexuality, nationality, and religion. Ashley Grossman, writing for Thought Co., makes the point that ultimately those in power will most benefit from moral panics since they lead to increased control of the population and the reinforcement of the authority of those in charge. The panic aroused in the leaders of Black Lives Movement and their allies provides the government or state or those acting behind the government or the state, the deep state, quote, to enact legislation and laws that would seem illegitimate without the perceived threat at the center of the moral panic. Hence, they can take any episode, anything, and make it everything. And therefore, there is no parsing, there is no deeper thought, there is no critical action upon that thought, there's just raw rage. So who loses in this? Legitimate change for what needs to be corrected. Unfortunately, our entire country, not just the demonstrators of Black Lives Movement and Antifa, has entered a moral panic phase. The vitriolic propaganda in both parties, the greed and opportunism of the oligarch and corporate elite in every one of our institutions, and they control every single institution. If you doubt me, ask how is it that the banks are allowed to fail upwards and be bailed out always for making bad choices, and yet they say they don't like socialism, but it is socialism that has endeared them to stay alive in business another day, where we are not benefited. We are not, as small businesses, we're not saved. They are. And that's every industry. I could show you the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industrial industry. They're all the same at that level. So when you take a look at the corporate elite and you look at the alt-right and the QAnon and the woke left, what you're dealing with is you're dealing with the mainstream media guiding them through their efforts. And the pandemic is only adding to this corrosive environment of social breakdown. But remember, with every breakdown, someone else is in control. Someone's profiting from it politically, ideologically, financially. Repeatedly, woke students are demanding their schools and colleges to assure that they are safe from ideas and philosophies that challenge their fragile comfort zone. No need to read Thoreau, no need to read Walt Whitman, no need to read Eurydicles, Sophocles. No. Those would challenge us and make us feel uncomfortable and unsafe, and our life would be threatened by a new idea. So we don't want those. Burn those books. And was there a book burning 2 weeks ago on the weekend in Portland? Yes. And what were they burning? The Bible. Well, why were they burning the Bible? What if they had burned the Quran? Where there would have been a different outcome from the media? Oh, you bet. But the Bible was okay to burn. Wow. Book burnings. Where have I heard that before? Book burnings, challenging people, breaking windows, harming people, shaming people, erasing people. It's happened before. Teachers and professors whose students feel are challenging their illusions to knowledge and self-identity, either real or imagined, are being ostracized with calls for administrative dismissal. How many academics are forced to remain silent to avoid the consequences of the new woke inquisition? Such student actions are indicative of their frail sense of self-worth and existential angst. Yet we must look at modern parental upbringing and our culture's leading elders, as noted by Jonathan Haidt, to diagnose the causal factors of this psychological catastrophe of two entire generations walking into the abyss. Consequently, when collective panic has reached a threshold, Cohen's theory might explain the sudden eruption of irrational behavior entangled in the Black Lives Matter and Antifa demonstrations, the burning of police facilities, toppling and destroying statues, public shaming and humiliation, and widespread looting, violence, and roguery. And it is equally endemic to the reactionary malfeasance of white supremacists and militias, occupying several blocks in Seattle with armed militia, extorting small store owners, and engaging in a frenzy of bullying does not portend a peaceful transition to a more virtuous society. So when a new book emerges, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, and becomes the holy grail of woke truths, we are lectured that what will not be tolerated is any deviation or heresy from the new norm it espouses. The author's central theme is that if you have the misfortune of being born with the wrong genes, with the wrong family, with the wrong skin color, you are a racist from birth till death, and you will be such for the remainder of your days. Hence, every white person is condemned with a defective moniker blazed across their forehead. And since meritocracy likewise is damned, all achievements are counted for as having the privilege of being Caucasian. Your attempt to defend yourself and profess your free speech is a testament of your heresy. No apology or act of humility or contrition can save you. It is a life sentence without parole for good behavior. White Fragility will now be taught in many schools with the full cooperation of teachers' unions and school administrators. Resistance will be a subversive act, an admission of your racism. It is critical to observe this may be heading towards a new paradigm of Orwellian social control, where the anti-racist profound and proclaimed will now ultimately be the new racist. Yet there is barely a shred of credible scientific evidence to support D'Angelo's hypothesis that can be readily deconstructed and debunked. It is a flawed opinion, and a demonic opinion, in my opinion, and a dangerous one at that. Worse, it is long-reaching conclusions could advocate for a regressive and repressive regime of scientism that Nobel laureate Bertrand Russell warned about. Russell warned that collective passions have a penchant to inflame hatred and rivalry towards groups other than their own. He was actually aware and acutely incensed that science is no substitute for virtue. The heart is as necessary for the good life as the head. And D'Angelo's screed falls into the dark abyss waters of genetic determinism that gave rise to racist fascism. Russell further warned that this distorted over-reliance on faux science could be a curse to mankind. If you're going to read her book, read Mein Kampf, Hitler's Story. It portends what happens when an entire race, ethnicity, is then condemned for not being Aryan enough. And look at the outcome of that Holocaust. We should be reminded how quickly and how easy the wrong message, a distorted message, a demonic message, can hold itself in sway within true believers' brains and turn a person into something that is anything but human. Perhaps during its Icarus moment, wokeness will self-destruct under its own rashness in the internal fire of its undiscerning ardor. What carnage it leaves in its wake remains to be seen. In conclusion, yet there is nothing new or original in the cultural rebellion we are witnessing. This game has been played out before in previous acts, striving for an adolescent and unreachable social perfection. It will have its blowback. In his Principia Mathematica, Isaac Newton observed that for every action there is an equal opposing reaction. However, we have yet to witness how it will boomerang. But it will. Mark my words, it will. You've got 200 plus million Americans who do not like how they're being castigated and dealt with when it's nothing in their life that measures to that kind of shaming. In the meantime, a new class of wannabe priests is emerging within the woke movement, a priesthood David Hume warned about in his essays, Moral, Political, and Literary, which will in turn be an adversary to liberty. Consider the backlash after Harper's Magazine published a letter on justice and open debate that warned, quote, of a new set of moral attitudes and political commitments that tend to weaken our norms of open debate and toleration of differences in favor of ideological conformity, end quote. It was signed by over 160 brilliant minds and academicians and authors, liberal and conservative, including Noam Chomsky and Jonathan Haidt and Suzanne Heschel, Steven Pinker, Gloria Steinem, etc. The letter gives a stark warning of the unwelcome consequences of the new culture of censorship that the demonstration's leaders are usurping into the nation at large. The woke now demand retribution against its signers. So even to sign a letter suggesting that we should not be censoring gets you censured, in effect shutting down the nation's 200 plus years of free speech, the right to disagree in public discourse. It is gone. Have those rebelling in the streets and casting out society, those who disagree with them, consider earlier precedents of their actions? It was the Spanish Inquisition in principle. How many today are in effect labeled heretics and witches because they have spoke publicly in favor of freedom of speech to oppose censorship? May not the woke movement in turn become the harbinger of a new Inquisition, a new platform of economic and social persecution by the powerful and wealthy waiting in the quarters after the cult of woke fizzles out? The causal problems to our terrified culture is, of course, far deeper and has been identified and analyzed repeatedly in the writings of Chris Hedges, and Henry Giroux. Our nation thrives on victimization of others, best exemplified by Trump's example. now the once victims of the woke generation erupting from the simmering of their silent angst and meaninglessness are determined to be the new victimizers. What is the end game when a populist uprising demands by disillusioned and psychologically traumatized youth at the mercy of capitalism's parasitical march to claim more victims gets the upper hand? The movement has now evolved beyond its original demands for racial justice for the black community, who have been discriminated against by our institutions, particularly law enforcement and the private prison system. Now it is rapidly morphing into a massive autonomous cult of divisiveness and self-righteousness without the moral backbone that recognizes the essential values of forgiveness, reconciliation, and cooperative engagement for preserving a sane and productive culture that benefits all. It is highly unlikely the demonstrations and revolt will slow down. More probable, it will be permitted. In fact, it will be motivated to increase in order to further destabilize society, in order for more repressive and draconian laws to criminalize thought crimes and actions. Eventually, American democracy will be in name only. The plutocrats wait for that moment. Only then will the populace wake up and realize that the forces of power metastasize throughout the nation, while the media kept us distracted and entertained. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening and have a nice day.